Good morning, everyone. Here now is the latest news of the war, reported by the NBC staff of Americans in foreign capitals. For news of Great Britain, we take you now to London.
This is London. Bert Baird speaking. The Italians say that Royal Air Force bombers were operating over Naples and Brindisi last night. A delegation from St. Dunstan's, the blind institution here, marched to the cenotaph this morning and laid a wreath of poppies in the shape of St. Dunstan's badge. The delegation was headed by Sir Ian Fraser and his wife and included some blinded servicemen of this war. There are no official or large-scale ceremonies here this Armistice Day, and we're told that in occupied countries they've been banned by the Germans. The Admiralty now announced that three Italian destroyers were sunk and two seriously damaged in the early morning of November 9th. In the action itself, two destroyers were sunk and one seriously damaged by British gunfire. Later, however, a submarine intercepted the remnant of the Italian convoying vessels and sank one ship, torpedoed it, and badly damaged another destroyer. Authoritative circles have no information to confirm press reports that the Vichy garrison in Djibouti has surrendered. As far as they know, there were no negotiations for the complete surrender of Djibouti. French sovereignty was to remain. Whether the garrison has now capitulated to the blockade is not known. The British some time ago offered to evacuate French women and children, which undercuts that Vichy protest about starving French people to death. Following Mr. Churchill's reference yesterday to a possible peace offensive by Germany, this question is a live one in London this morning. An official spokesman said again, the British government have fairly reliable information from a variety of sources that the Nazis do intend such a move. Swedish correspondents from Berlin, however, report hot German denials. The war, they say, will be fought out and not conference-tabled out. This spokesman admitted more or less that a great many of the smaller so-called neutrals and smaller states that have been overrun are very interested in promoting peace because they know that in the spring they'll be called upon to furnish more troops to help Germany fight the Russians. A broadcast by Vichy this morning may be significant, either in this matter of a peace offensive or in the expansion of the world conflict referred to by Mr. Churchill yesterday. The broadcast said that Senor Sunier this morning conferred with the German and Italian ambassadors and the Japanese minister in Madrid. It's learned in London today that the transfer of an annuity of £600 in sterling, it's about $2,400, has been allowed to be sent out of the sterling area to Marshal Pétain in Vichy because he took out a policy in that amount with a Canadian assurance company in sterling in 1927. An exception to the regulations prohibiting the export of sterling for such a purpose was made in Pétain's case because he was the head of a state with which the Canadian government maintained diplomatic relations. It was stated that no other amounts have been transferred to Pétain except that £600 a year, and that there was no knowledge of Pétain having any other property in Britain. Some people have suggested that if exceptions were made for enemies of Britain like Marshal Pétain, surely something should be done to allow the parents of children evacuated abroad to make similar transfers of sterling. Modifications to existing regulations are said to be under consideration. When the question was asked yesterday in the Indian Council of New Delhi, as to the whereabouts of Subhas Chandra Bose, the Secretary of the Home Department said it had been common talk that he was either in Rome or Berlin. Bose is 44 years old and is a strong-arm revolutionary. He's a believer in direct action, tough methods. He spent a good time in jail. He organized a general strike when the Duke of Windsor, as the Prince of Wales, visited Calcutta in 1921. He was at one time president of the All India Congress Party, but was ousted by Gandhi. In the conference yesterday at New Delhi, reference was made to leaflets, which have been made their appearance throughout India. One of them apparently says, the day for a rebellion in India has arrived. A pact has been signed at a conference in Berlin. The revolutionary Subhas Chandra Bose was present. The other reads, Bose is now in a European country, maintaining close contact with the Revolutionary Party in India. He has already issued a statement signed by his own hand. He's busy with certain foreign powers. Bose had been released from jail early this year because of ill health, put under detention in his own house where, in his own words, he retired into mystic contemplation. Mysterious seems to apply because nobody here knows how he got out of India. We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
That's the news from London this morning. Now, from the NBC newsroom in New York. Russian dispatches indicate widespread Soviet blows against Nazi lines in the arc before Moscow. Observers believe the attacks are aimed at preventing reorganization of the invading forces for a new thrust toward the capital. A major Russian counterattack is said to be in progress around Serpukhov, that's 65 miles south of Moscow. The Reuters news agency says the Reds have wiped out German forces trying to cross the Ok River. Farther south, according to Reuters, two Nazi tank attacks have been thrown back on the snow-covered front around Tula. A Nazi force is said to be surrounded by Russian pincers near Volokolamsk. From Berlin, German military dispatches concede that there's been little progress toward widening the Nazi wedge in the Crimea between Sevastopol and Kerch. The Russians, admittedly, are offering fierce resistance from mountain and hilltop positions. And now, for a report from a neutral observer in Europe, we take you now to Bern, Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Ronnie from Bern. Over here, the armistice anniversary is just another day to most of the people in the occupied country. German authorities would like the people to forget all about the significance of November the 11th. They banned all demonstrations, and German soldiers are patrolling the streets of most of the larger cities in the occupied countries on the lookout for any infractions of the order. The citizens of Paris are told to keep away from the Arc de Triomphe, not to bunch up on the streets, and above all, not to attempt to place any wreaths of flowers under the Arc or before any of the memorial monuments. The same general order holds good in the other cities in occupied France. The Germans threaten the people with severe reprisals if any incidents occur. The Vichy government's Secretary of Interior has appealed to the people in the occupied zone to obey the German edict to the letter, reminding them of the incidents of a year ago. In Belgium, the same situation exists. The German military authorities have announced that extremely hard measures will be taken against those persons who insist on observing the day in the customary way. Here in Switzerland, nurtured in the last war as well as the present one, Armistice Day isn't officially observed as such, but this morning I was surprised to see people, presumably British and Americans, walking the streets with red poppies in their lapels. There's no German military administrator here to prevent that. Coming on the eve of Armistice Day, Prime Minister Winston Churchill's scorcher is being used in part by most of the press today. While none of the Swiss papers I've seen this morning make any comment, most of the people I talked to last night and today say the British leader was in top form, lambasting away at the Axis with both barrels. Britishers here were particularly cheered at Churchill's announcement that England has now reached air parity with Germany. To them, this was news and big news. They point out that his flat warning to Japan was clear and unmistakable. That it means that Britain's strength in the Far East is an important factor that Japan must reckon with if her armies move. Nor did I find any dissenters to the Prime Minister's remarks about a possible German peace offensive. Everyone I talked to agrees that there can be no peace with Hitler. They all seem to get a particularly big kick from Churchill's cutting references to the Italian fleet. On the whole, the impression is that Churchill's speech reflected a new optimism that seemed to be lacking in Hitler's Saturday night address in Munich. Now everyone is waiting to hear what President Roosevelt has to say. In Russia, the battles in the north, south, and around Moscow wear on. According to reports here, there's little change in the Moscow area, although the German General Guderian is said to have launched a heavy tank attack in the region of Tula. Fighting in that district is sharp, but it seems that the Germans are making little progress. The Soviets claim that intense artillery barrages are smashing the attacks as soon as they start. About 100 miles south of Leningrad, the Russians are counterattacking in a desperate effort to recapture the important railroad junction of Tishvin. But so far, the outcome of the battle is unknown here. At Leningrad itself, the situation remains unchanged. The fiercest battles are on the Crimea, where the Germans are hammering away at Sebastopol and Kerch. Apparently, the Germans are giving Sebastopol all they've got. According to the Russians, the Germans are keeping up an almost incessant artillery and air bombardment, which is only interrupted when the storm troops attack with tanks and flamethrowers. The Reds claim the German losses in this area are enormous, and the Russian impression is that the German high command has given the order to take the Soviet naval base at all costs. The weather is bad all over Russia. In the far north, in the Murmansk area, operations are totally paralyzed by blizzards. No snow has fallen at Leningrad. There's less snow in the Moscow region, but enough to make it tough for both the defenders and the invaders. In Ukraine, the temperature has fallen, and the tributaries of the Donets and Don are frozen. The weather is nasty on the Crimea, where the Soviets report alternating rain, hail, and snowstorms. This is Charles Lanius and Barron returning you to NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news on the war. Now for a report by NBC's veteran reporter in our own capital, Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks, and the veteran greets you. This being Armistice Day, and the unknown soldier who rests so peacefully on the slopes of beautiful Arlington across the river could easily tell you that he had died in vain in the war to end wars. And the President of the United States, who, as a younger man and as Assistant Secretary of the Navy at that time, did so much to build the 1917-1918 Navy against the U-boat menace, speaks to the nation, especially to its soldiers and sailors from Arlington, today at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And that would be that. The soldiers and sailors may be thinking of something else, but that which is worrying their headmen here no end is whether or not there will be enough steel produced to go round. The steel mills depend on those so-called captive mines, and the 53,000 miners therein have been refused a full union shop as a part of the contract with the mine owners, and now the next step is up to the mine union president, John Lewis, who ordered the men back to work until 1915, breaking the strike temporarily there, while the mediation board went over the demands of the union and the attitude of the owners, and advised late last night or late yesterday afternoon that a union shop is not necessary to defense. The CIO spokesmen who have said anything about it so far merely say that this is a rotten decision. However, neither the miners nor the mine owners are bound by the advice of the board, but Washington expects Mr. Lewis to call a strike, and that there will be a showdown between Mr. Lewis and President Roosevelt. The government seems to be getting ready for this showdown, ready to run the mines as an emergency matter. Mr. Roosevelt, in a note to steel industry heads last night, said that free government in the world depends on the output of steel and that nothing must get in the way of that output. Incidentally, always remember that John Lewis is an unpredictable gentleman, except that he has a goal in mind and he intends to get there if he can. It may be that in this particular instance, he will not do the dramatic expected thing and order a strike and so forth and so on. You simply can't tell about Mr. Lewis. The Navy gets ready to run those 10 or 12 big building projects out there in San Diego. They include hangars and fields and target ranges and so forth and so on. The land establishment, shore establishment of the Navy. And they've been halted by American Federation of Labor strikes among the building workmen, but there is a bit of a delay in that showdown because this day is a labor holiday, and by tomorrow the men striking may go back to work. They have been urged and invited to go back to work by government officials here after the admiral on the job expressed the opinion that this San Diego strike is a revolt against the United States. You may recall that the Ways and Means Committee, which writes tax bills, received the Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, in closed session and then hurriedly swept under the bed the horrendous suggestion for grabbing a slice of your pay before ever you saw it. Well, they said that was too big an order for them right now, but the Secretary now has the backing of his boss, the President, who writes a letter to that committee urging it to get busy with just such a salary-grabbing bill for 1943. The President follows through on the same idea that Mr. Morgenthau has, that there's so much spending money in the United States, there will be an inflation, a boom, and maybe a collapse. Might as well get the excess now. And the way things shape up, it would look like a 22% income tax for anybody getting any kind of money at all. But still, the committee is shy and coy. Its chairman, Mr. Doughton, informs the President that the House is about to consider a price control bill, which is aimed at cutting down inflation, and after that, maybe taxes. And that's all from Washington at this time.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.